didn't get any juice and you're upset. It's time to rebound. Life goes on. Don't have your feelings hurt and assume that we just juiced you today because we wanted to, or didn't juice you, as the case may be. We are dealing here now with this phrase, the four winds of the earth, and the concept as it relates to the principle of divine judgment specifically. And, of course, or judgment in general, but divine judgment, as we saw, we were talking about the rains descending and the floods coming there in Matthew 7, 24 and 25, that this represents figures for various calamities and tests that come in life. So 39, the phrase the four winds is used 8 times in the Bible, but this is the only place where it is qualified by the genitive of the earth. As we observed in Daniel, the four winds of heaven refers to the unseen spiritual forces that act on the sea of humanity, resulting in the formation of certain national entities in the last days. Daniel 7:2. As we pointed out when we did this book, it's important to note that Daniel 7, of course, is not a simple retelling of Daniel 2 in other terms, which 90% of the interpreters out there will tell you that it is. It does not. Here, by very definition of all things, once again, the preposition, these little forms of speech that are so critical to interpreting properly, indicates that these four entities, the lion with the eagle's wings, the bear, the leopard, and the other horrific beast, all have to be on the earth simultaneously, that they are not a chronological sequence, as determined by the end of verse 7 there in Daniel 7, it was different from all the beasts that were before it. That word means in its presence, as in not before it chronologically, but there with it. So the interpretation of this chapter has to be based on that, strangely enough, one little preposition, which indicates this is not a retelling of Daniel 2, nor is it supposed to be. So we see this, and I, Daniel, was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Well, clearly, one of the things that you would probably suspect is that heaven doesn't have any wind, per se, literal wind. Because wind is a direct result of pressure shifts, high and low pressure, and the gradient in between them, and all of that, and how close the isobars are related together. And we see, we can't say the wind blows. We have to be scientific. The wind doesn't blow. The wind is generated by pressure shifts. Now, God, how anal is that? Well, we understand that. So, but the four winds of heaven refer to four distinct forces, as we might say, that operate on planet Earth. So again, wind is uses a perfect example of this and a perfect figure for it because winds are unseen. I mean, no one sees the wind. We just see the effects of it. And so we don't see these spiritual forces that are operating on the planet or impacting the planet, but we see the results of them. And I don't look at Marilyn Manson and assume this is the result of God's work, handiwork. I assume it's a result of some unseen spiritual forces that, do God knows what to this guy. You see the results of it, in effect, though. And that's why wind is a good analogy for this. So 41, in our context, the four winds of the earth would seem to denote unseen but real earthly forces that act in a significant manner on this planet. And 42, the four primary winds of earthly power that affect civilization on the entire planet are military power, political power, religious power, and I'm talking there in the sense of false religions per se, and economic power. This is what determines the course of human events, in effect. And all of these things act on the earth, but I mean, you don't see, quote, you can't see military power. I mean, you can see the army, as it were, but the military power itself is invisible. So 43, a study of the phenomenon of wind reveals that if four winds coming from different directions were released simultaneously, the effect would be a massive whirlwind that would be catastrophic in nature. And 44, this passage is then symbolic of the fact that God will restrain certain aspects of human power until he is ready to withdraw his restraint and then allow these four powers of humanity to act as they choose. apart from God impeding them. And in a sense, that is what we look at in this concept of the seals. As the seals are broken, these forces are set in motion, or more accurately we might say, they're not restrained as they were before. There are certain aspects of Daniel's 70th week that are simply no more than God withdrawing his restraint and allowing humanity to do what it wants to do. And we have lost, and that of course was the challenge there in Psalm 2, let us throw off their cords. As the leadership of the earth, of all the world, is engaged in this conspiracy to eliminate God from history. Well, it's going to be kind of tough, but that's what they're going for. So, in effect, God will just stop restraining all at once. And much of this occurs, as we know, at the rapture, that the restraints are dropped at that point big time, but not fully. And then they're dropped even more and more as we go, and we'll see that the results are catastrophic. When mankind is left to itself, we'll see what happens. And you don't even have to be a believer on doctrine. You can go out there and research it, and people have been saying for years that mankind is very self-destructive. This is not new news. And so if mankind wants to operate apart from God, he will let them and withdraw his restraint of evil, and here we go. We're going to be on a roller coaster ride that ends up in hell, however, unfortunately. For most people, that's where it's going to go. So, 44, God is not going to restrain them at a certain point and allow them to do what they so desperately want to do. 45, this fits quite well with the fact that the events of the first six seals are basically caused by men. As the seals are broken, i.e. restraint is removed, and not by what we might call, quote, a direct judgment from God. 46, this passage is teaching also that none of the horrific events that have been described up to this point will come to pass until God sovereignly allows them. And we have to talk about this in some ways in an academic sense, because, I mean, you can't really put yourself into that place. I mean, you can't imagine what this is going to be like when the balloon goes up. It's going to be beyond human comprehension in some ways. And yet people will live through it, rationalize it, and move on. Now go figure. So, this event and also what occurs after this will not happen until God's ready for them to happen. And in effect, he's told us all about this in the future, one, to demonstrate his omniscience, that he knew all, he's got foreknowledge, he knows all the facts of human history. None of this takes him by surprise. And that's not going to happen until he's ready for it to happen. And so this is designed, obviously, to make it in some ways easier for the believer to faith rest these things and to recognize, well, okay, God's allowing this, or he's doing it, and whatever the case, I need to orient to it. And that's not always, that's, of course, easier said than done. All I've got to do is orient to God's will for my life. Well, that's a piece of cake, isn't it? Every moment of every day. All I got to do is just think the right things, say the right things, and do the right things. Well, we can all do that, can't we? Yeah. Well, it's a little tougher than it sounds, of course. So, 47, this is confirmed by the negative purpose clause, hinamei, which has the sense of in order that not, or lest. At 48, the final phrases regarding the earth, sea, and trees are designed to point to the physical environment, which is so absolutely necessary to human survival and quality of life. And the reality is God's not going to let man destroy his environment until he's ready to. And this takes into account all kinds of issues like positive volition, the change of dispensations, concluding the church age, and all of that, and the appearance of Antichrist, and none of this is going to happen until God's ready for it to. And he knows exactly when to set these motions in motion, and he'll do it. The earth involves the things that come from the earth, cultivated crops, other natural resources, which would certainly impact those that depended on such things. And we all depend on food, there's no doubt. B, the sea emphasizes the maritime fishing, trade, or traffic, and would impact all that rely on the seagoing commerce and travel for their livelihood. As you know, typically people that live along coastal areas very often rely on the sea for their livelihood. And those that are engaged in whatever, the military aspects in the Navy, and all of that, Coast Guard, various aspects that people rely on, fishermen, crab crabbers, lobster men, and all that. So that's going to be adversely impacted, as we're going to see. And then C, the trees, interestingly enough, emphasizes the necessity of this natural resource, as they provide shelter, warmth as fuel, cooling from shade, health through medicines derived from their barks, trees and flowers, leaves and flowers, beauty, that's another aspect of trees, as there were part of the reason trees were put here in Eden, was to look at, and the very oxygen that we breathe. They're very critical in terms of the whole photosynthesis process, just as other green plants are as well. But that's one of the things that I don't think, and it became clear to me more as I studied this, that people haven't even thought about the effects of nuclear warfare, chemical and biological weapons on the environment itself. What will it do to the process of photosynthesis? And the reality is, if all the green grass is burned up, if you look ahead in chapter 8, a third of the trees are burned up in verse 7, and all the green grass is burned up. And that doesn't just mean like grass out in your yard. It has to do with all kinds of ground clutter, ground cover, and various grasses that people use for food, like rice and barley and corn and, you know, various things like that. Not corn per se, but rice and barley and other grasses that they use to feed hay and all that. And all this is burned up. How does this affect the photosynthesis cycle? And the idea, of course, the answer is adversely, Ron? Yes, adversely. And what happens is that oxygen is depleted from the environment and not replaced. And this causes, if you understand the photosynthesis cycle and how it works, these plants absorb carbon dioxide from our environment, which is poison to us, and form it through photosynthesis back into oxygen and release it into the atmosphere. So what happens if the environment becomes heavily laced with carbon dioxide? Well, as we're going to see, a lot of things can happen that are very critical to the human race and its survival. And so people might say, well, why are the trees here big whoop so they can't hurt the trees? Well, the trees are real important, as we're going to see. So 49, clearly the destruction of any one of these things would have devastating consequences for the human condition. One cannot truly fathom the result of the destruction of all these things on a worldwide basis. 50, as even negative believers or unbelievers recognize, where are Mother Earth's, and of course they can't say God, so they have to say Mother Earth, but what are their life support services worth? In one sense, their value is infinite. The Earth's economies would soon collapse without fertile soil, fresh water, breathable air, and an amenable climate. And that's one of the things they're going to lose, is an amenable climate. And that obviously is going to create other weather-related problems that we will see coming up in this. So 51, however, as was made clear in chapter 6, mankind is so stupid, devoid of knowledge, that they actually destroy the very environment they need to survive on this planet. And that is the height of stupidity. That the human race on a global scale would destroy the Earth. And that's referenced here, by the way, and I don't remember specifically where it's at, but I know that, I think it's chapter 16. Well, must not be. I don't see it now. But there's a verse in here that delineates the fact that it's right for God to stop these people because they're destroying the earth. And God's going to judge this. He's going to judge the environment, of course, as we will see. But then again, part of this gets into idolatry. People worship the earth, and that is obviously a judgment on that as well. As we're going to see, especially as we get into the trumpet judges, very much parallels the Egyptian plagues and why God did that to Egypt. And why he's doing it again on a global scale now at the end of time. So 52, from the doctrinal perspective, it is quite comforting to know that even the earthly forces that would destroy the planet are controlled by God through the agency of angels. That he's got this under control. He's not confused, and they can't do anything before he lets them or wants them to. And I saw another angel, now verse 2, ascending from the rising of the sun. That just simply means from the east. having the seal of the living God. And he cried out with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea. And I saw, again, another, Alas, another of the same kind. This is not a fallen angel. This is a regular angel, just like the others were. Another angel, Angelos, ascending, is anabino. It's a participle here. This word means to go up, literally. To ascend, present active participle, or to go up, ascending from the Anatole, literally is from the rising. That word, that's what Anatole means, is rising. A-N-A-T-O-L-E, this is the preposition apo, with the genitive feminine singular, from the rising of the sun. And then you got the genitive masculine singular of Helios. The same phrase is used, by the way, in Revelation 16:2. Having, present active participle here of attendant circumstance, having a seal of God. Here the word seal is now made definite by the genitive that follows, the seal of God. Sphragus is the word, and it's a seal. Same word that's used of the seven seals on the scroll. And we'll deal with this and what seals were used for and all that. We'll deal with all that as we go. Having a seal of God, or the seal of God, genitive of theos, of the God living, present active participle of Zao, obviously emphasizing the attribute of eternal life, that God is always alive, who was, who is, and who is to come, that all things flow from God and all things flow to God. There is God, there is history, and then there is going to be God. And, of course, God is always there in the meantime as well. The living God, and he cried out, aorist active indicative of kradzo, which means to shout or scream or holler. He cried out with or in here, depending on whether you want to translate this as an instrumental or a locative, in a great voice, means loud voice. Obviously, phoné is the word for voice or sound. Depending on context, if they're talking, we say voice. Saying with a loud voice to the four angels. The four angels in context has to refer back to the four angels in verse 1. Saying to the four angels, to whom, relative pronoun hosts, in the dative here, to whom it had been given, to them, this is a little bit wordy in the Greek, but it's redundant in some ways, to whom it had been given to them, but emphasizing the fact that they were the ones, the recipients of it, and that didymi, the verb to give, is a passive here, outside agent. Someone gave them the power to hurt, we might say, to whom it was granted, as they've said here, they translated didymi as granted in the New American Standard, which is fine, which emphasizes the grace aspect of it, that God controls these things and he gives them to whom he pleases. And he gives his power to these angels. To whom it had been granted to harm. You got an aorist active infinitive of adikeo. A-D-I-K-E-O. To harm or inflict damage. Here this functions as the subject of didymi. This is what they had been given, to inflict damage. This is the subject of it. To damage or to harm the earth and the sea. Hege, and again, thalassa, the word for sea. T-H-L-A-S-S-A. Saying, do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we seal the bondservants of our God on their foreheads. Saying, present active of participle again here of attendant circumstance. In a sense, he's rising and saying this. As he's going up, he's saying this. That's the whole thing here. The participles appear to be simultaneous with one another. As he's rising from the east, he's talking in this loud voice. And what's he saying? Do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees. Aorist active imperative here of adikeo again. Now this also presupposes, I mean clearly, that nothing has been harmed at this point. I mean that's the logical reading of this, and the natural sense of it is that nothing has happened yet. And they're holding back this wind, and they're commanded to hold it back a little while longer. Do not harm the earth or the sea, hege, nor meta, air conjunction, or the sea, thalassa again, or the trees. Dendron here, an accusative neuter plural. Until, preposition acri, which denotes a temporal use here, until we seal, aorist active indicative of sfragizo, the verb, the cognate there from sfragis, for the noun for seal, until we have sealed the servants, doulos, definite article here. This word means an abject slave, a bond slave. The servants of God, literally of our God. You got of God, genitive of theos, with the genitive of ego. Of our God upon their foreheads. Preposition epi plus the definite article plus metopon. M-E-T-O-P-O-N. Eight times this word's used only in Revelation. The word forehead's never used anywhere else, at least not in the New Testament. Literally, it means the space between the eyes. We translate it forehead or brow is the idea. I mean, the idea is it's the upper part of the nose up. It depends on how big your nose is, I guess. But between the eyes is, you know, where that is. So foreheads is a good translation of this, and that's fine. And I heard the number of those who were sealed. 144,000 sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. And Kai, I heard, aorist indicative of akouo, the number, arithmos. Arithmos, actually. The accent is on the last syllable. And I heard the number of the ones having been sealed, literally, or the ones being sealed. You've got a perfect passive participle. Again, the angels are doing the sealing here, outside agents. And obviously, so they are receiving this seal. And all the usages of this word are in the perfect tense. So sometimes when you see a word like that and it's only used in one tense, it means that it came, was understood as literally a present. The ones who were sealed or were being sealed. 100, hekaton. H-E-K-A-T-O-N. 100, then you got tesseraconta, which is tesseras plus an ending with hekaton. At 100, and that means 40 then. Or 100, 40, and 4. And then the word kilias, 1,000. C-H-I-L-I-A-S. 144, and it's actually a plural, literally. 144 thousands, because when they use plural numbers, they would use a plural ending with it. So 144,000. Now contrast this with Revelation 5:11, where, see, here's the first thing. Interpreters don't want this to mean 144,000. So why does it say 144,000? Well, it's just a big number. Well, why not pick 169,000? Why not pick 300,000? I mean, a big number. It's a specific number. And he says he heard it. And it's clearly designed for him to hear. And interpreters, big majority of them, just say this number is not literal. This number means, and it refers back to 5:11, where he says, I looked and I heard many living creatures, and they were myriads and myriads and thousands of thousands. John knows how to write a big number without being specific. And this is not just a big number. This is a very specific number. 144,000, as we see, sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. And we're told that this relates to 12 tribes of 12,000 each, which gives us our 144,000. And so this number is specific. It's designed to be specific. It's drawn. It has its attention drawn to it here. And it's not just a big number or a large group. And they want to spiritualize this. They want to explain it, you know, explain it away as just something other than what it is, when in fact it is what it is. It's 144,000 people. All males, by the way. No females, just men. 144,000 sealed from every tribe. Sealed again as spragus, or spragizo, the verb, having been sealed or being sealed. Preposition ek, from every tribe. You got pos with the anarthrous noun phule. P-H-U-L-E. And this means a standard or a tribe. It's a clan, we might say. But we understand the tribes of the sons of Israel. We've heard it. We should be familiar enough with that term to understand it. The tribes of the sons, genitive masculine plural, huios, of the sons of Israel. The phrase sons of Israel is used 635 times in the Bible. And you know what it means in every case? What it says, sons of Israel. It's Jewish people from whatever tribe. And here they said from every tribe of the sons of Israel. And so sons of Israel cannot be interpreted, and then you've got the word Israel, which of course was Jacob's new name, the sons of Israel. Okay, point one here now. The second part of this supplemental vision is introduced by the very common phrase, "and I saw," which continues to emphasize the preferred form of testimony. Eyewitness testimony is the best. It is to be preferred in all cases where we can get it. Two, John now sees another angel, who is identified variously by interpreters. However, if an angel is not named in this book, as is true in the vast majority of cases, it is useless to speculate, since no dogmatic identification is possible. A whole bunch of them make this Gabriel. Why? Well, they've got their reasons, but the text doesn't say. And that's one of the challenges for the interpreter, is to stick with the text and not speculate. And the text doesn't say who this angel is, and we're not going to say, because we don't know. And a certain amount, as we have pointed out under the doctrine of angels, as we pointed out, the Bible really is not a textbook about angels either. I mean, it deals with angels and it touches on angels, but we're not here to understand everything about angels. They're not the important part of this. They play a part in it, but they're not the focal point. And so people want to get off on all of this. Again, they've categorized various angels. There's nine distinct categories. Whatever. Think what you want. But the Bible is vague on certain things, and you have to acknowledge that it's vague. And this is where, as a doctrinal believer who's intellectually honest, you have to step back sometimes and say, you know, we don't know. It's not a sin to say you don't know, by the way, if you don't know. What is a sin is the arrogance of suggesting you know when you don't. And we don't know who this angel is. And I say that because there's many such texts that either are vague or allow a multiplicity of interpretations that have to be taken seriously and consider for their merits and all of that. And you may be able to work through it and arrive at the final one. And the Bible's meant to be understood. But how does knowing who this angel is impact your phase two production as a believer? The answer is it doesn't. And so certain things are truly unimportant. So again, dogmatically identifying this angel is stupid in my opinion, because it doesn't say. And you have to be intellectually honest and admit that. So three, this angel is described by the adjective alas, which means another, to denote that he was of the same nature as the four elect angels mentioned in verse 1. You have two distinct words for another in the Greek language, alas and heteros. And alas generally means one of the same kind, whereas heteros means one of a different kind. And so he is clearly, point 4, an angel with great authority, as seen in the fact that he commands the other angels and is in possession of the seal of the living God. So this is not, as we might say, this is not any mean angel. This is an important angel, no question. 5, the angel is observed moving from a lower place to a higher one. That's what ascending or going up means. As he is ascending from the rising of the sun. 6, the phrase from the rising of the sun is another idiom. That means from the east. And this figure has occasioned a great deal of discussion. Why is he coming from the east? And interpreters will spend hours discussing this. And I can give you one simple little answer. Because that's where he was. That's where he was. So why agonize over this? And the thing I see is as I watch these, you know, interpreters, and I read their work and I check out what's going on out there, is they will spend the longest amount of time on the most insignificant of events and miss the major point of what's going on. And that's almost universal out there among them, as they isolate on the minor points and the major points go unexplained. And hopefully we won't do that. Well, 7, some have taken this as a symbol of divine blessing, since the east is the first source of light and the direction in which Eden was established. As it says there, God planted a garden eastward in Eden. So they say, okay, this was the first place of blessing that God formed on the planet for mankind. So this idea of blessing must predominate in this phrase. Well, eight others see this as an allusion to Ezekiel 43:2-4, and suggest that this refers to the glory of the Lord and the direction by which he enters the millennial temple. And in that passage, Ezekiel there, this is mentioned specifically, the east. Then he led me to the gate facing toward the east, and behold, the glory of the God of Israel was coming from the way of the east. And his voice was like the sound of many waters, and the earth shone in his with his glory. And it was like the appearance of the vision which I saw, like the vision which I saw when he came to destroy the city. And the visions were like the vision which I saw by the river Kebar, and I fell on my face. And the glory of the Lord came into the house by way of the gate facing toward the east. Okay. Well, A here, this is unlikely since we are not dealing with the Lord here, but an angel. And our passage has nothing to do with the third temple. Now, there's some question as to whether or not the third temple becomes the millennial temple or is it destroyed and rebuilt. I'm not going to agonize over that because I don't know that we're told. But one, this isn't the Lord coming up from the east. This is an angel. And I recognize that in the Lord appears very many times to use the term east as one of his favorite directions for whatever reason. A lot of these things come from the east. And apparently in satanic thinking, the west symbolizes Satan's direction. He tends to have a fondness for that for whatever reason. Probably because it's opposite the east and he's a liar and he's got to do everything the opposite the Lord does. I don't know. But the point is, again here, 9, since the angel is viewed as rising in the east just as the sun does each new day. This is likely a prophetic way of describing the new day for the remnant of Israel, which will eventuate in millennial blessing. Malachi 4:2 talks about this in prophetic terms. But here, once again, referring to the Lord specifically, but for you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in its wings, and you will go forth and skip about like calves from the stall. Ultimately, of course, this new day for the Jews in some ways begins following the rapture. Not that we don't see certain aspects of Jewish culture headed towards this direction, but the real blessing for them doesn't come until the remnant converts, and that's following the rapture, as we'll see. So that has some merit to it, in my opinion, that if you want to agonize over why he comes from the east, well, this sort of does signify a new day for the Jews in a lot of ways, as we're going to see, because, one, the church age is over, and we are now back fully into the age of Israel. And they are, once again, God's chosen vehicle for dealing with the earth, as the church was taken out. Well, 10, as in the passage in Malachi, there is a strong contrast between the events of the day of the Lord as viewed from the perspective of those that are negative and the perspective of those that are positive. In the Malachi passage that we had there, 4:1-2, you see that you have the day of the Lord is coming like an oven or a furnace, and all the arrogant and every evildoer will be chaff. And the day is coming that will set them ablaze. But for you who fear, and then you have this contrast, who fear the name, who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness will rise with healing in its wings. And also, as we saw at the end of chapter 6 in Revelation, the aspect of how the negative view all this and what they think of it. They want the rocks and the mountains to fall and hide them, and they recognize that they're going down. They may not like it, but they recognize it's true. Well, 11, this angel is depicted as having the seal of the living God, which is designed to picture the fact that the angel is carrying God's signet ring, or what we might call his official stamp. 12, in the ancient world, the signet ring was used by kings, officials, and those in authority to authenticate documents, validate ownership, provide protection and privilege for those that had it. 13, in the Greco-Roman cults, the seal was very closely connected with the god being worshipped and provided a special power to the one wielding it. The suggestion was that one that had the seal was under the protection of that particular god. And B, in the cults of Cybele, Attis, and Mithras, the worshippers were sealed to indicate that they belonged to that god. And we have, obviously, taken out of the isagogics of the culture in which they live, this brought over into reality, that this is truly the seal of the living God, and it does validate ownership and provide protection and privilege for the one that has it. And so these people, obviously, that are going to be sealed are very important to God. Whatever else one might say about this passage, if he is putting his own seal on them, this speaks volumes about what his plan for them is. So, 14, the signet or seal belongs to the living God, which is a common designation in both the Old Testament and New Testament to denote the reality of God's eternity, his eternality. This title being found some 27 times. 15, clearly this is designed to contrast the God with the dead idols that men have chosen to worship over the course of human history, as well as to contrast it with his current activity on behalf of his people. See, God is actively involved in the lives of his people. Now, people may sit around, they may bemoan their state, they may say, why is everything going so bad for me? Well, you're asking the wrong person, ask God. He's in control of life. And so, God is active on behalf of his people, and he can bless them or he can jam them. And in some cases, he does nothing more than let them run their own little deal into the ground. I mean, in some cases, God doesn't have to do anything. He can just watch you go out and crank up so much self-induced misery and discipline that he doesn't have to do anything. And so, but ultimately, it should be evident from here and other passages that God actively desires to bless his people. That God is not in the jamming business, we might say. That's really not what he's all about. Now, he'll do it, but it doesn't mean that he wants to. Just ask any good parent. Really, I mean, if you're a good parent, you don't look at your children every day and say, I just hope you screw up so I can nail you. One, they're going to screw up enough. You don't have to hope for it. And two, normal parents don't think that way. Normal parents love their children, want the best for them, will do anything for them, up to and including laying down their life for them. And God is very much the same way. He gets a bad rap. But a lot of things that happen in the lives of people, God has nothing to do with. They do it to themselves. And then, of course, God just gets the blame. He's the scapegoat. It's God's fault. Well, no. God may not be blessing you, but if he isn't, you better figure out why. That's your problem. So, 16 here, while modern humanity may not be involved in the worship of inanimate representations of deity, you probably don't have a Buddha in your house, and you probably don't bow down to it, even if you do. We are clearly engaged in the worship of money, power, sex, celebrity, technology, science, medicine, and a host of other things that cannot provide salvation or security. And the people in this world look at all the wrong things. The biggest thing we worship is celebrity, in America particularly. But we also worship a lot of other things. And we've got to keep up with all the current advances so we can be happy, right? And yet these things don't bring happiness, they don't bring security, and they don't bring comfort. When you're in the middle of a big test, how fast your computer runs doesn't really help you, does it? Unless the big test is solving some big mathematical problem where computer speed's helpful. No, it doesn't make any difference, does it? You know, it doesn't matter how many miles to the gallon your car gets when you're sick, does it? You probably don't sit around and think, well, that's good. I get good mileage. No, when you're sick, you don't think about that at all. Well, we focus on all the wrong things. Obviously, sex is a huge part of this, money, power, and all the people we exalt and all of that. And it's worship. It is absolute worship. They don't call it American Idol for nothing. And not just that show, but all these, quote, alleged celebrity shows. I mean, Joe Millionaire, you know, I'd rather have a root canal than to watch that. I'm not interested, frankly. I'm not interested in any of this junk, to be honest with you. It doesn't do anything for you. So again, we worship in this world a lot of things. And we worship the drug companies that make the medicines. They get all the breaks. We know that they basically run Congress. It's not any big secret. People are aware of these things. But really, what we worship in America is security. And we will give away our rights and our freedoms just to have security. And guess what? We're not secure, but people aren't interested in hearing that. Well, 17, this angel now shouts with a loud voice, providing instruction to the other four angels that were introduced in verse 1. In 18, the loud voice is a phrase that is used some 19 times in Revelation, and it certainly emphasizes the importance of what is being said. One, when somebody's saying something in a loud voice, you better check out what they're saying to you. It could be quite important. Maybe that's why they're hollering. Some people just like to holler. Okay, well, you're like the boy that cries wolf. You holler too much. And hollering doesn't always communicate, but sometimes it does, and you better listen when they're hollering. At least determine what they're saying. 19, in this case, it is designed to draw attention to what is being accomplished among the remnant of the positive Jews on planet Earth. 20, the four angels he addresses are the same four angels that were introduced in verse 1. And here, we learn that they had been granted the right to harm the earth and the sea. 21, the verb didymi, to give, is used regularly throughout this book to denote the sovereign determination of Jesus Christ to allow individuals the power, right, or authority to act. 22, it was used several times in chapters 2 and 3, and Jesus Christ was clearly the one promising to give certain blessings to believers. For instance, there at the end of chapter 3, verse 21. I will grant him to sit down with me. A lot of the SG3 promises are used in concept or in the context of this term didymi, to give or to grant. And Jesus Christ grants to people what he wants them to have. For instance, if you look ahead in chapter 9, and not necessarily, we might always say, in a good sense. Chapter 9, the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven which had fallen to the earth, and the key of the bottomless pit was given to him. Well, who do you think gave it to him? Jesus Christ. He's the one that has the keys of death and Hades from Revelation chapter 1. And the bottomless pit's in Hades. So who gave him that key? Jesus did. So why would Jesus give a fallen angel a key to the angelic prison? Maybe he just wants to see what the angel will do with it. Well, guess what? He runs and opens the prison. But I think Jesus knew he was going to do that. I'm fairly certain. He knew that he would open that pit and let these demons out. And that's an interesting deal. We'll get to that as we get to it. But so clearly he has all authority. And that's what he said. All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. And he administrates that authority as he sees fit. And if people don't like it, too bad. It's his authority. It's his power. He certainly has earned it. He certainly is the only one, as we saw, who is worthy here in chapter 6, or chapter 5 we saw. So 23, while the latter portion of verse 2 mentions only the ability to harm the earth and sea, the fact that the trees are omitted in this verse is not significant, since they are mentioned again in verse 3. You have the earth, sea, and trees in verse 1. Then he just says the earth and sea. So some interpreters said, see, he can't harm the trees, but that's dumb because he tells him in verse 3 not to harm the trees. So the omission of trees here does not materially affect anything in terms of the interpretation. 24, the Greek term that is translated harm is quite appropriate in this context since it has the nuance of suffering wrong or injustice at the hands of another. In effect, that's what dikeo is, the verb really to be righteous. And adikeo, or to do righteousness, or to do the right thing, and adikeo means the opposite of that. Not doing the right thing. Not doing righteousness. And so it comes to have a nuance. If you're doing someone wrong, you're harming them. And all that that involves. So 25, the wrong the environment suffers in this context is not specifically due to God's actions, as much as it is based on the destructive practices of mankind, which the angels are restraining. And that's the whole deal. These four winds that blow on the earth, whether it's military power, political power, economic power, or religious power, are destructive. And mankind hasn't seen the full destructive nature of these things till yet. But they're going to. And these destructive forces are going to be allowed to maximize now. And people have done damage on planet Earth, no doubt. I mean, you know, the areas where they've tested nuclear and atomic devices, you know, are still charged with radiation. That area is permanently damaged. And all of that. So, but those are isolated places. I mean, and they've exploded them here in Florida. You may not know about it. But they've set off nuclear tests here in Florida. So it's not as though we're immune to, you might think, well, they did all this out west in Nevada or wherever. No. No, they do it all over the place. So we obviously haven't seen the full impact, though. I mean, having a small isolated area in a nuclear test that's contaminated for years and decades to come didn't really materially affect a lot of people. However, when we start making it global and worldwide, it's going to be a different ballgame. So again, the wrong that the environment suffers, as we're going to see, is very much due to mankind's actions and, quote, not God doing it per se. Certainly he allows it and he knows about it and he removes the restraint so they can do it. But that doesn't mean he did it per se. Now, some judgments he definitely does. We'll get to those. 26, the command to the four angels is recorded in verse 3, which makes explicit that their restraint of the four winds of the earth was what prevented damage to the earth, sea, and trees. 27, this restraint is only to last to a certain point, as seen by the use of the Greek term akri, the preposition there, until, or a conjunction rather, that denotes the terminus ad quem, that's the ending point. You hold these back to a certain point and then don't hold them back any longer. Once we get to that point. Now, what is the point that they have to hold them back until? They have to hold them back until we have sealed the bond service. Until our work is done, you have to restrain these winds. In other words, you have to restrain mankind. Angels control at a certain level mankind and keep them from doing all these stupid things that they're going to do in these chapters. Some of them we've seen and some of them we're going to see. But they haven't thought this through. Clearly, mankind has not thought it all through. So 28, as mentioned previously, the purpose of the sealing of the bondservants of the living God is to denote ownership and provide protection from the coming devastations. All right, well, geez, is it 12 o'clock already? I guess our time is up. We will continue on with this here on Wednesday, where we will resume. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen. Thank you.